You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Four Horsemen of the Forever War by Chris Whipple. And yet, Biden came to believe the war was unwinnable. He was souring on the government, warning that it could become a criminal syndicate. The bickering warlords, the opium trade, the armed forces' dubious morale. He opposed almost every troop increase requested by Obama's generals. By the time he decided to run for president, Biden was going with his head instead of his heart. Until mid-August 2021, Biden and his White House team had been regarded as avatars of competence. Against domestic foes, a crippled economy, a debilitating coronavirus, they were the best and the brightest, ruthlessly executing ambitious blueprints to put checks in Americans' pockets and vaccine shots in their arms. These domestic enemies were surrendering, slowly but surely, to science and organizational know-how. But an intractable conflict, half a world away, was something else entirely. Judging an ally's will to fight is not a science. Neither Biden nor his brain trust at the CIA and the State Department expected the Afghan armed forces not to be there, like the National Guard at the outset of the assault on the Capitol. The ensuing chaos was a logistical and strategic nightmare. It was also a black eye for Biden. His reputation for efficiency and empathy was tarnished. Biden's all-star national security team, one of the best ever on paper, was shell-shocked. As Washington Post columnist David Ignatius put it, these are people who never got a bad grade in school. Biden, in time, will get credit for ending an unpopular war. But surely those old soldiers, Washington and Eisenhower, would have done it better. Many outside the administration saw trouble brewing. On August 9th, a week before all hell broke loose at Hamid Karzai International Airport, I spoke with Admiral James Stavridis, who, under Obama, had commanded thousands of American troops in Afghanistan. Sooner or later, the world has a way of showing us that it will have its way with us, he predicted. The first example of that may be Afghanistan, as the wheels really come off there. That's going to be awful to watch. After the debacle, Card told me he thought Biden's national security team needed a handful of really deep contrarians to say, wait a minute, what are you doing? To make sure you don't get gangthink. Panetta agreed. We don't know whether or not there was that contrarian in the room saying, you're about to take one of the biggest gambles of your presidency, and you'd better damn well be prepared for any contingency, he said. I refuse to believe that we couldn't have done this in a better way. Did the ugly departure diminish the American sacrifice? Four presidents spent more than $2 trillion, lost nearly 2,500 American lives, shed American blood, treasure, sweat, and tears, in the words of National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. Card thought Biden had sold the American effort short. Success in Afghanistan, he said, would truly take a generation. We were just about at the end of half a generation. But a few days after the fall of Kabul, Stavridis told me he'd reluctantly concluded in retrospect that the war had been doomed from the start. The central failure of Afghanistan was our certainty that we could create a modern, democratic, centralized government with a strong national army. We always knew it would be mission very, very hard. History should have taught us it was, in fact, mission impossible. Before his sudden death from a ruptured aorta in December 2010, Holbrooke, the maddening, indispensable diplomat, had summed up America's painful naivete about Afghanistan. Sitting through yet another optimistic military briefing, he jotted down something he remembered from a Peanuts comic strip more than 40 years earlier during Vietnam. It was a comment by Charlie Brown after his baseball team got slaughtered 184-0. How can we lose when we're so sincere?
That night in Ravello,
In his new memoir, Baggage, the actor Alan Cumming recalls a whiskey-soaked evening 20 years ago with author Gore Vidal at his six-story villa, perched above the cliffs of the Amalfi Coast. Opening photo, Italian Airy. Gore Vidal owned Ravello's 1930 landmark, La Rondinaia, from 1972 to 2006. Only weeks after the 9/11 attacks, I flew from New York to Tuscany for the wedding of two dear friends. Afterward, I traveled south with my then-boyfriend for a weekend stay at the storybook villa in Ravello of Gore Vidal, the American man of letters, who once described himself thus, "I am at heart a propagandist, a tremendous hater, a tiresome nag, complacently positive that there is no human problem which could not be solved if people would simply do as I advise." I had met Gore earlier that year in New York City when I took part in a reading of his play, Visit to a Small Planet. I wasn't really a fan of the play, but it isn't every day you get to meet someone like Gore. The whole thing was very glittery, with Tony Randall and Lily Tomlin among the cast, as well as my old chum Kristen Chenoweth, who had played Lily St. Regis to my rooster in the Disney remake of Annie 2 years before, and Christine Baranski, whom I'd go on to have many years of fun with in The Good Wife. Like many people, I was both fascinated and slightly scared of Gore. I loved his stories, and he loved that I loved them. I was flattered by his attention and the invitation to visit him in Italy, but at the same time, I would never want to be on the wrong side of him. He was a legendary drinker, but the few meetings we had were usually breakfast or lunches, with maybe a glass of white wine, the extent of the alcoholic consumption. So, I had never seen the other side of Gore's personality. All of that was about to change. When we arrived a little late after a taxi ride along the Amalfi Coast that was both the most terrifying and most beautiful car journey I've ever had, Gore had greeted us in a shaft of moonlight at the door of the villa. Ice cubes clinking in the whiskey glass he held aloft, and ushered us into his Rococo study, where Howard Austin, Gore's longtime partner, was completely plastered. "We started drinking at 6, and so your tardiness is the reason for us being a little buzzed," Gore slurred. I asked Howard how he was doing. He peered up at me out of a huge armchair next to the drinks table that made him seem even more diminutive and impish than he actually was. "I'm floating," came the reply. I really liked Howard. It must have been hard to get a word in edgewise living with Gore Vidal, and so, perhaps, that gave him the time to hone his one-liners down to such a degree that every single one was a gem. Gore had once described Howard to me, not in his presence, of course, as a wisecracker, and smiled with a rare fondness. And that is exactly what he was, especially that evening. Gore showed us upstairs to our room. Golden yellow drapes hung at the huge windows, and the walls were festooned with slightly menacing gilt eagles. Behind the two voluminous sofas that abutted the marble fireplace was a four-poster bed, and books, books everywhere. "This is gorgeous," I gasped. "It was Princess Margaret's room," Gore said over his shoulder as he stepped unsteadily out onto a terrace with the most beautiful view I had ever seen. We were so high up that the sparkling lights from the ships moored up and down the coast for miles looked like fireflies. There was another little room off the terrace that Gore told us had been the maid's quarters, but now housed all of his foreign editions. "I am published in 62 languages," he almost moaned. "They keep sending them to me. I have to have somewhere to put them." We freshened up quickly, then went back downstairs to join our host and four other dinner guests. Gore and Howard, doing their well-worn double act, were on a roll. I once spent two successive Christmas Eves in Paris in the company of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, Gore declared. Howard, fixing us cocktails from his seated position next to the drinks table, deadpanned, "Just lucky, I guess." We all roared with laughter. Howard handed me my drink and winked. There was some little French accordionist playing, and the Duke didn't know the words of the hymns in English. He kept lapsing into German. He was a supporter of Hitler, but I don't think he was intelligent enough to know what Nazism was, Gore continued, undeterred. By the time we sat down to dinner, prepared by a famous Japanese chef who was vacationing nearby, the mood was quite raucous. Gore and Howard were not very au fait with Japanese food, and at one point, Gore, who had refused chopsticks, forked up a huge mound of the hottest wasabi I had ever tasted, and was about to swallow it whole. The table exploded in cries of panic, especially the chef, who had just regaled us with the list of ingredients in every dish, and was obviously acutely aware of the consequences of a drunk 76-year-old ingesting this thermogenic condiment. But Gore, who was seated next to me at the head of the table in a very low chair, "Have you shrunk?" Howard had quipped, refused to heed anyone's advice. And like the willful, wicked schoolboy he was, held the forkful of wasabi in front of his mouth, his eyes darting around the table to be sure we were all watching, then swallowed the lot of it. We all waited for something to happen, but miraculously he did not explode. He gave a silent toss with his sake glass, and we all followed suit. But then, under the cover of the nervous, stilted conversation that finally resumed at the other end of the table, I heard him emit a series of weird grunts. Howard was being charming and getting a lot of attention, and I could tell Gore was becoming a little jealous. He asked me what I was working on, and I told him I was trying to finish off my first book, a novel, but what with all that had been going on over the last few weeks, I was having a little trouble. "Well, of course you are. You're not a novelist," he snapped, without looking at me. I said nothing. I knew exactly what was happening. Sadly, a response like this was an old standby for bitter old queens of a certain age. They show you kindness that you mistake as respect. Then they bring you down or humiliate you when they know you can't or wouldn't retaliate, because actually you want to protect them, not embarrass them. I knew this was in Gore's lexicon, and I had even imagined something along these lines happening during this visit. In a way, it was a sign that he liked me enough, or trusted my kindness, to be that cruel. And also, of course, in a way, he was right. I wasn't a novelist, yet. There was a rather long pause that I wasn't going to break. Not with Gore's belly full of whiskey and sake and wasabi, and his speech slurring and his eyes straining to focus. Also, at that moment, I actually held the upper hand. I found Gore boring and wished I was farther up the table, listening to Howard being witty and hilarious, which I knew would be a dagger to Gore's heart. "Write about what you know," he said quietly. I wanted to say that was exactly what I was doing, that my novel was a thinly veiled romanclef about my debaucherously fun deep dive a few years prior, overlaid with my still very present physical yearnings for fatherhood. But I didn't have a chance. He was off. You get around the world, you meet interesting people, you have ideas, write them down, and analyze, he said with great emphasis. Right about this weekend, he continued, looking over his sake glass at Howard, write about two men who have been together for over 50 years and yet have hardly ever had sex. Analyze it. Their relationship did indeed fascinate me. They had been together at that point for 52 years and seemed completely dependent on and loyal to each other. But Gore had written copiously about his other lovers, his fear of commitment, and that he had never been in love except once, briefly, with his fellow schoolboy named Jimmy Trimble, whose death, soon after their teenage love affair ended, haunted him and his work. Palimpsest, Gore's memoir, was a paean to Jimmy. I wondered how Howard felt about all of that. Next photo, visiting artist Vidal and partner Howard Austin, shown in 1974, who invited fellow provocateur Alan Cumming, pictured here in 2001, to their Ravello villa. I had finished reading Palimpsest just a couple of hours earlier, rushing through the last chapters on the train that afternoon like a guilty schoolboy cramming for a tutorial. And now here I was, listening to the man himself recount many of the anecdotes I'd so recently read. It was like having drinks with a living audiobook. When he started the one about Greta Garbo saying to Cecil Beaton that she wished her genitals got smaller as she got older, it was all I could do to stop myself from chiming in with the punchline. Gore and Howard had met in the aptly named Everard Baths on 28th Street in New York City in the late 40s, where they had had some sexual contact, mostly in the presence of others, as Gore delicately put it. Gore talked fondly of those halcyon days when men of all sexualities gathered in bathhouses. It was cheaper than a hotel, and they could get blown, and where, he said, you could have anyone. Even sitting down, Gore was swaying now and beginning to needle me. He could feel I was taking him up on his challenge, and by questioning him about his views and past adventures, I was indeed trying to analyze his and Howard's relationship. So he kept throwing challenges back. "Don't you hate commitment?" he asked wickedly, knowing my boyfriend was within earshot. "No," I said, thinking carefully. "I don't hate it." "But you obviously aren't that fond of it by the way you responded." "Well, I was beginning to feel a little uncomfortable, and Gore could tell and was loving it. It's not that I'm not fond of it. When I make a commitment, I like it. I just don't like to feel trapped." Gore's eyes sparkled, and he flashed a vulpine smile, no doubt honing his next salvo. I decided to retaliate. The hunted became the hunter. "You seem to be the one with the commitment issues, Gore." There was a pause for a moment. He slurped more sake. "Oh, yes." Suddenly, Gore reminded me of Tommy, the eponymous hero of my unfinished novel, shagging everything he could and refusing to be pinned down or defined. But unlike Tommy, he had enjoyed all that in his life, and commitment. Gore had no commitment issues. He had been committed to Howard for more than half a century. What he had a problem with was admitting his commitment. He then started to talk about never having loved. "What about Jimmy Trimble?" I asked. Yes. I could tell he was torn, half pleased I had done my homework and read his memoir, half pissed off I was interrupting his lament. "I didn't realize how much he meant to me," Gore conceded. "But you were never really in love with him, were you?" I pounced, knowing the answer already, but wanting to hear him say it aloud. "How could I have been? We were so young. We were just friends fooling around." Of course, Gore could be an exponent of my least favorite American phrase. "He was just a teenage infatuation," I pushed. "Yes." "So you have never loved, Gore?" "No." I suppose I should have been outraged that Gore Vidal had just confessed to me that the central theme of his memoir was a lie. But I wasn't. A human being in his 70s, sitting in front of me, asking me to believe he had never been in love, was far more outrageous. Just as he had never properly acknowledged the commitment he had made to Howard, he couldn't admit to ever having been in love. Next photos, Wuthering Heights. The often caustic Vidal, in a 2006 Vanity Fair portrait, would famously entertain guests at his home, pictured here, known for its transfixing vistas. I couldn't understand it. The usual recipe of shame and self-loathing you might attribute to a man of his generation in such a scenario just didn't wash. He'd been very vocal about his male partners and his female ones. In fact, let's face it, Gore was pretty vocal about everything. His first novel, The City and the Pillar, is very graphic in its description of a gay relationship and caused a sensation when it was first published in 1948. It's not as if he had a problem with admitting he liked cock. He just had a problem admitting to liking the rest of the person a cock belongs to. "You Brits are more prone to affection and sex," he said, reaching for the sake bottle. "You make that sound like a bad thing," I replied. The subject was closed. Gore was finished. Later, with yet more sake sloshed into our glasses, Gore launched into another elaborate and racy story. Things were getting pretty woozy by now, but I seem to recall this one was about a youthful Prince Philip and the coterie of European aristocrats on whose kindness he had depended. Howard interrupted with another wisecrack that made us all howl. And the next thing we knew, Gore was up and out of his seat, staggering against the kitchen doorframe as he exited stage right. A big, huge baby in a big theatrical huff. He did not return. Everyone was a little embarrassed, and Howard seemed genuinely worried. But then someone suggested a nightcap, and the promise of alcohol numbed his anxiety. When the other guests had left to drive home to their villa, I told Howard to go to bed and that I would clean up. Well, it can't be too bad. He must quite like me. We have been together for 52 years, he said, his ever-present cigarette wobbling in his mouth as he spoke. I thought it both sad and strangely sweet to be that insecure after all that time. And with that, Howard bade us good night. As we climbed the stairs to the Princess Margaret room, I heard voices coming from the study, where Gore had retreated and Howard had now joined him. They were bickering. Through the open door, I saw Gore hunched over in a chair, balancing a tumbler of whiskey on his knee. He glanced up and our eyes met. "Good night, children," he said sadly. As we reached the bedroom door, I could hear their argument continue. I sat down on the top step and listened. Suddenly, I was taken back to my childhood home, and the many times I sat on our stairs, attuned to the raised voices of my parents, my stomach clenched in anguish, wondering if it was anything I had said or done that had sparked this latest conflict. "You weren't using your brain, Howard. You didn't know what you were doing. You were so drunk," growled Gore, who at this point was barely intelligible himself. "This is not working, Gore. It's not working, period. I have got to get out of here." I heard Howard leave and start down the stairs to their bedrooms below. "Oh, good," I remember thinking. "He only means he has to get out of that room." But then, after a few seconds, came Howard's final departing cry. "I am putting the lights out now, Gore, and don't worry. In the morning, I will be so out of here." "Oh, my God," I thought. "They are splitting up." I was present on the very night a 52-year relationship ended, and all because I was late and they got so drunk before dinner. I am partly to blame for Howard and Gore breaking up. Please note, I had been drinking heavily myself. In the morning, my boyfriend and I crept downstairs, fearful of the carnage we might find. At first, we couldn't find anyone at all, but then a little Italian lady appeared and ushered us out to a terrace overlooking the Amalfi Coast and a table set for breakfast, where Gore and Howard were sitting, crashingly hungover. But when they saw us, they perked up immediately. "Wasn't that a fantastic evening?" asked Gore. "I really needed a blowout after the tension of the last few weeks," agreed Howard. Considering I had expected Howard to be gone, his appearance, as well as their glowing review of the previous night's shenanigans, left me stunned. We sat down, and our breakfast order was taken. Under the table, I absent-mindedly slid my hand onto my boyfriend's. The tabletop was glass, and so Howard saw this gesture and immediately swatted his napkin at me. "Not in front of Maria," he hissed. I quickly withdrew my hand, confused, suddenly ashamed, but not sure why. Already following Gore's advice of the previous evening, I began to analyze what had just happened, and I was filled with sadness that not just love, but tenderness, or even touch, had no place here, even under the table, in a home two men had shared for more than 30 years. This article is from the book Baggage, Tales from a Fully Packed Life by Alan Cumming, copyright 2021 by Alan Cumming, reprinted by permission of Dye Street Books, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. the bone collector. In 2014, the FBI discovered an entire museum and thousands of human remains in the home of a 90-year-old Indiana man who hosted the Boy Scouts and claimed to have detonated the first atomic bomb. Was he a pillar of his community or the most prolific grave robber in modern American history? By Josh Sanborn, with illustrations by Leonardo Santamaria. Opening illustration. Don Miller collected more than 40,000 artifacts over six decades, the largest private stockpile the FBI has ever uncovered. And this illustration shows shelves covered with artifacts. And next illustration, an anonymous tip led Agent Tim Carpenter of the FBI's art theft program to investigate. He couldn't believe what he found inside. Tim Carpenter dreams of places he's never been. He'll find himself somewhere deep in China, gazing at a Buddhist temple, posing as if he's being photographed. Or sometimes he's on Easter Island, near its carved human figures with oversized heads, outside centuries-old burial caves, almost like he's unearthing something. Then he wakes and realizes none of it was real. He's never visited China, never seen Easter Island. His dreams are someone else's trips and memories that exist in weathered photos and grainy films. Strung together in his mind like a phantom reel, images he's looked at so many times, too many, that they've invaded his psyche. One evening, years earlier, in October 2013, Carpenter, an FBI agent, heard his phone ringing at his home in Indianapolis. His supervisor was calling to tell him of an anonymous tip about a man in rural Indiana named Don Miller. The tipster said Miller was an amateur archaeologist who'd amassed a vast collection of artifacts, especially Native American items. Inside his home, the person claimed, were skulls, bones, and entire skeletons. At the time, Carpenter was one of a handful of agents working for the FBI's art theft program, typically known for investigating fine art. Stolen Renoirs, lifted Rembrandts, fakes and forgeries, heist famous and not so famous. He admits that agents who are aware the unit even exists think they're just the guys who chased down Van Gogh's. But the program investigates all kinds of cultural property crimes, including something as unusual as potential human remains inside a Midwestern home. Carpenter reached out to the tipster. They talked for an hour. The person who'd seen the collection kept referring to it as huge. For Carpenter, who'd worked art crimes for 5 years, including private collection cases, a large collection would have meant 100 items. So, what's huge? 200 items? 400? No, man, a lot more than that, he told Carpenter. I think it's about 200,000 pieces. Carpenter's initial reaction was to dismiss it. Not possible. Either this person is a crackpot or has wildly overshot. Nobody has 200,000 of anything, Carpenter told me. Hell, most large state museums don't have 200,000 pieces. So Carpenter pressed him. It can't be that many. Just trust me, the person told him. This stuff is everywhere. The tipster said Miller had acknowledged that some of the items in his collection were illegal, and that over the course of six decades, Miller had dug much of it up himself. He said Miller had a bomb shelter and underground tunnels on his property, and put Carpenter in touch with someone else who'd seen the collection and taken photos. Carpenter saw them. There were skulls and bones. They were unmistakable. At the Indianapolis field office, Carpenter ran Miller's name through the FBI's databases and discovered he'd been in touch with the agency 5 years earlier. In 2008, agents had received a tip that Miller had two spheres that looked like pits, the cores of nuclear weapons. When the FBI, along with Department of Energy officials, visited Miller's home, they didn't find pits, but discovered a chunk of depleted uranium and a large bar of graphite Miller claimed was from the U.S.'s first nuclear reactor. Carpenter says the DOE seized the uranium, which he described as not something you'd want to handle, but left the graphite after deeming it inert and harmless. But clearly, agents had been in Miller's house. They'd seen the collection. It was documented in some paperwork in the past as a passing note like, oh, by the way, he had this really cool collection of Native American stuff, Carpenter said. But the agents weren't cultural property experts. They didn't know what they were looking at. Next, illustrations. Miller was always eager to show off his collection, but some objects he kept hidden. His basement museum included display cases packed with Chinese jewelry, dinosaur eggs, shrunken heads, Nazi helmets, Aztec figurines, Celtic axes, and more. Carpenter decided he needed to see the artifacts for himself and thought up a way in. He would tag along on a follow-up visit with one of the agents who'd been to Miller's house before. A bit of a ruse, Carpenter told me. On November 1st, the two agents drove an hour south, past farms and cornfields, to Moscow, a tiny, unincorporated township in Rush County. They pulled into Miller's driveway. Just past its curve sat a large two-story beige stone home. An old white farmhouse stood out back. Large antennas in the yard poked at the sky. Nearby sat multiple barns, outbuildings, garages. The agents, casually dressed, approached the front door and noticed a statue, a Chinese terracotta warrior, life-size, standing guard. Miller opened the door. He was tall, thin, elderly, happy, eager even, to invite them in. He seemed thrilled to have someone to talk to. Inside, his house was cluttered. Miller guided them through, talking about himself, his life, and his collection, and soon led them down a stairwell. As Carpenter descended, the room below felt as if it was expanding with each step, like a camera aperture widening and widening until he finally reached the bottom. I just stopped, Carpenter said. I stood there and looked around like, you have got to be shitting me. Stretching out before him, arranged on row after row of collapsible tables, inside glass cases hand-labeled and lighted, Carpenter saw a wall-to-wall, floor-to-ceiling private museum. One man's life's work on exhibit. Over here, 2,500-year-old Chinese jewelry. There, an Egyptian sarcophagus. Here, a dugout canoe that traveled the Amazon River. There, dinosaur eggs, a Tibetan cowbell, a fossilized crocodile skull, pre-Columbian weapons, Ming Dynasty vases, shrunken heads, Nazi helmets, Aztec figurines, Celtic axes. In that brief, spiraling moment, Carpenter estimated 10,000 artifacts. Then he realized he was only seeing half the room. The rest was behind the stairwell, and remembered the multiple buildings surrounding Miller's home. It was a gut-wrenching butterfly in the stomach, oh my God, I think my life has just changed kind of moment, Carpenter said. They spent a couple of hours going around the room, Miller describing how he used metal detectors on battlefields and Native American reservations, telling them how he'd personally dug up each artifact. Carpenter trying to take it all in, looking for the bones and skulls he'd seen in photos. Miller's wife, Sandra, coming down to offer them tea. Carpenter saw things that were almost certainly illegal. Pre-Columbian artifacts protected by treaty. Chinese items that fell under the country's wide-reaching patrimony laws. It all started, Miller told him, in New Mexico in the 1940s, when he worked at the Los Alamos National Laboratory on the Manhattan Project for J. Robert Oppenheimer himself, the father of the atomic bomb. In one of the glass cases, Miller showed Carpenter a photo of an orange mushroom cloud. Nearby sat a radio system Miller said sent the signal to detonate the very first nuclear device, Trinity. Don claimed to have been the guy who fired the first atomic bomb, Carpenter said. Miller told them he was so close to the explosion that he ran and hid in a bunker before the blast wave hit. But when he wasn't working on the most profound scientific project of the 20th century, he combed the base for arrowheads. After a couple of hours, the agents thanked Miller for having them over and drove back to Indianapolis. Carpenter knew that private collectors typically display about half their collection and keep the rest in storage. Leaving Miller's house that day, Carpenter, a Tennessee native who refers to his guesstimates as Kentucky windage, estimated 20,000 objects on display, putting Miller's full collection around 40,000, less than the tipster's estimate, but still the single largest private collection Carpenter, or the FBI, had ever come across. Carpenter doubted everything was illegal, but it was possible the agency would have to seize it all. And how exactly do you seize 40,000 priceless artifacts? But something else puzzled him. Carpenter had expected to find human remains, the bones and skulls he'd seen in the photos. The only bones he saw were a femur buried on a shelf and part of a skull cap sitting upside down like a shallow bowl. Miller told him the skull was from a Native American who died at Wounded Knee, where up to 300 Lakota were massacred by the army in 1890. He showed them the bullet, a small ball, lodged in the skull. But that wasn't in the photos. The bones weren't there. Frank Densler was barely a teenager when his Boy Scout troop visited Miller's home in the late 1960s. Miller, dressed in plaid and blue jeans, loved showing the kids around. Always polite, never a braggart. He didn't have kids of his own. He had his collection. Knowing Don, I would say he was probably afraid that if somebody didn't save these items, they'd be dug up, burned, built over, Densler said. Something would happen to them, and nobody would ever know. Next illustrations. Miller claimed to have fired the first atomic bomb, Trinity. The FBI seized a stack of passports with stamps from Cambodia to Canada, Iraq to Peru, but found no evidence of permits allowing digs. Miller was well known throughout his community, living almost his entire life in Rush County. He was born in 1923 and grew up in the white farmhouse behind his home. During World War II, he attended Ohio State University's Army Specialized Training Program, a partnership with the military that trained students in fields helpful to the war effort. Miller studied engineering, then got shipped off to New Mexico. Over the years, Miller often talked about his time there to friends and even journalists. He told a reporter for the Rushville Republican that Oppenheimer, whom he called Oppie, picked him to head the test bomb's firing squad and claimed to the Indianapolis Star that he gave the signal to begin the countdown to the Trinity explosion. After the war, Miller married his high school sweetheart, Sue, and received bachelor's and master's degrees in electrical engineering from the University of Illinois, graduating in the top 3% of his class, and a doctorate from Purdue University. In the early 1950s, he began working at a naval ordnance plant in Indianapolis, later named Naval Avionics, and started traveling extensively. Back home, Miller was often at the corner restaurant in nearby Rushville, drinking coffee and eating pie. If somebody wanted to see his latest finds, he'd tell them to come on over. People knew about the collection and his travels as a Christian missionary that also seemed to serve as archaeological digs. He would go on these mission trips and uncover something, find something, and maybe stick it in his backpack, Densler said. I don't think anybody thought that he was stealing the stuff. After seeing Miller's collection, Carpenter started reaching out to everyone he could think of, anthropologist, archaeologist, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Department of Justice. He researched the legal knot of treaties, foreign patrimony laws, state and federal restrictions, some more than 100 years old, that might apply. He was about to take on the biggest case of his career, only after a year of arriving in Indianapolis. When he was growing up outside Knoxville, Carpenter didn't imagine he'd be tracking down lost artifacts and artwork. If anything, he saw himself becoming an artist. But he got sidelined by Desert Storm when he became a bomb technician for the Air Force. In 2004, he joined the FBI, investigating terrorism cases, before getting burned out and requesting a transfer to criminal work. A couple of art cases came his way, and by 2008, a spot opened up on the Small Art Theft Program. Carpenter was its eighth member. Over the years, the program has recovered a 300-year-old Stradivarius violin, ruby slippers from The Wizard of Oz, Cezanne's and Monet's worth millions, alongside sculptures, memorabilia, coins, and books. More than 20,000 items, worth $900 million since 2004. But the FBI had never run across anything like Miller's basement. Carpenter decided he needed to see the collection again. This time, he showed up unannounced and asked more pointed questions. Miller told him about a Native American effigy pot his first wife, Sue, unearthed in the Southwest. A carronade made from a Gulf of Mexico shipwreck he'd obtained after hiring a local diver to haul it up, a pair of mastodon tusks from Canada he'd excavated on a road trip. You just went and pulled off the side of the road and went into somebody else's land and dug these up? Carpenter asked him. Oh, yeah, Miller said. He strapped them to his car roof and drove them over the border. Next, illustrations. Miller told a friend, if you can divert security on one item, you can get something else by them, something better. He baited them. And Miller said that he dug up each artifact personally. Miller said he and Sue, who died in 2000, often took long trips together in the summer, stopping at archaeological sites along the way. They'd dig, load up their truck, then drive it all back home. He said he usually found artifacts two ways, by talking to the locals or using ham radio. In the 1970s and 80s, Rick Bolt worked with Miller at Naval Avionics. In the mornings, Bolt remembers that he would see Miller sitting in his car, a dirty, utilitarian, metallic blue 1974 Chevrolet Malibu, engine running, the car plastered with antennas. He'd be carrying on ham radio conversations with somebody in Southeast Asia or South America, Bolt said. He didn't listen to the radio. He talked on it. Miller got his ham radio license in 1943, founded his own electronics company called Wyman Research, and helped develop SlowScan TV, a technology that transmits still images across high-frequency radio bands. In 1972, he was honored as Amateur of the Year by a ham radio convention and later helped get SSTV aboard the Mir space station, building the system that beamed back images of Earth in December 1998. Bolt remembers Miller as a walking, talking encyclopedia. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.